Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week, we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, some intelligence, humor, progressive persuasion. Brian's concept of less is more, more or less, always left us wanting more. So let's just jump in and check in with everybody here. Zooming in from his sick bed is my friend, flight instructor, Vachon Airport Commissioner, West Texas Roughneck, and Eastern Montana band member, former Army intelligence officer, and fellow treetop flyer, Truman O'Brien. Are you on the mend, Truman?
Well, I am indeed. As we're mentioning off the air here, I've got my I have my captain's voice on yet, which I'm afraid I'm going to have for a few more days yet. But I did test negative this morning, so that's a real step forward.
Hallelujah.
And indeed.
We're also joined via Zoom by the defender of democracy, Kevin Jones of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, who collectively strive to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here. And Truman, I'm glad to hear that a negative test result is somehow a positive thing for us. So glad to see you're on the menu.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you.
And zooming in from his home and still inhabiting the northern and western hemispheres, historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vachona, or is that Vachona?
Vachona.
Vachona. Long O. I have to remember that. President of the Vachon Heritage Museum and our own globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Holman. How you doing, Bruce?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm still wearing fleeces, and it's almost the middle of April, so I'm ready for spring.
My understanding that the sun will be coming out for the rest of the week, although it's supposed to get really windy here in the next hour, even more so, so... Keep the fleece on.
That's what they've been telling us for the last month. So. I'll believe it when I see it.
Really? Yeah. This week, our special small talk guest is Benjamin Hunter, Artistic Director of Northwest Folklife, to discuss the year-long activities of Northwest Folklife and the upcoming Memorial Day weekend festival. Welcome, Ben. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me, Craig. Pleasure to be here.
We are glad to have you. And you have a natural radio voice.
Oh, do I?
You do.
Yeah. He can be an airline pilot, too. That's right. You know?
And unlike the rest of us, Ben, you've got a face for television.
For television.
So this is what you do to all your first-time guests?
We do. And mine is the voice of Craig Bellis, former repo man, Pinkerton guard of Pan American's first 747, high fashion shoe salesman, constitutional law professor, two-time half-bright scholar, and former proud member of the Northwest Folklife Board of Directors.
All right.
That two-timing is not a bad thing in this instance, right? It's a good thing to be
a two-time. That is a good one. Right. That's right, a change. That's a good one.
Just thought I'd check in with that.
Let's go around one more time. This time, find out what you've been up to, Truman. I got a feeling you've probably been spending some time flat on your back.
Having been under house arrest for the last week with this stupid COVID, I've been a little bit stir crazy and being stuck here in the house. But I have started one thing. Years ago, I was regaling my older brother with one of my daring do tales of flying. And he said, man, you should write that up. And so I said, well, that's a good idea. So I did. And I just started writing up tall tales, of my adventures in flying. And so since I've been stuck here at home, I decided, I'm going to stick that all together into a book. And I don't know if I'll ever do anything with it, but it's kind of fun having them all string together and read it. So That's something fun to do, at least while I'm stuck here at home.
That's great. I, having spent a lot of time on the airplane, around the airplane in the hangar with you, I've heard many of those stories, and they are well worthy of publication. So
thank you. Thank you.
Great. Kevin, what have you been up to last week?
Let's see. I'm looking a couple things. The legislative session is steaming to a close here in another couple of weeks, and as we all know, we have this Vashon Mori environment and climate agenda that we've been talking about. And there's two bills that are now really starting to look like they're going to get to the governor's desk. One has to do with putting climate change planning into Growth Management Act, which is a huge accomplishment because that means that all those cities, municipalities are going to be looking for ways to cut their carbon emissions as a consequence. And also a plastic pollution reduction bill is moving forward. So that's awesome. And gives me a chance to shout out for the Zero Waste Vashon Choose Plastic Free campaign. They're going into their second area of focus now, which is to avoid those plastic produce and shopping bags. So keep your eyes and ears open for the word from Zero Waste Vashon on that. And the last self-promotional blurb that I'll say is there is a Quartermaster Yacht Club Tech Talk this Wednesday, 6 p.m. at the library, absolutely free. If you want to learn about boating in the San Juan Islands all the way to Desolation Sound, drop into the Vashon Library, and we'll talk about those awesome anchorages and places you really want to go, assuming you have a boat, to get there.
All right. Cool. That's a lot. That's a lot of good
stuff. It's a lot. Yeah, it was a busy week. Next week will be a slow.
Okay. Don't count on it.
I'm hoping.
Right. Bruce, how about you? What about your last week?
Oh, it's not as busy as Kevin's week, thank goodness. But fascinating thing. As you know, I spend time every year in New Zealand teaching. And this Friday, there's actually going to be a Kapa Haka workshop on Vashon. And haka is a Maori sort of chant dance kind of thing. And kapa haka is a broader sort of singing, dancing, you know, storytelling kind of thing. And so this Friday, actually, at the Methodist Church in the sanctuary area is going to be a workshop. It's an amazing number of Kiwis who have ended up settling in the Pacific Northwest and along the West Coast. And so a group on Vashon has set this up. So we'll be learning things that I learn every year when we work with the Maori Marae at the university we're at. But it's going to be interesting to sort of see it on Vashon. So I'm very excited about that.
I'm excited about that too. If you haven't seen Haka, it's moving. It is really, really moving. I have to tell you, I'm sure had this experience as well, Bruce, but when we were in New Zealand, somehow I finagled into being the chief of the visiting group as we went to the various, Maori, camps. And, so I had to stand there as the gentleman was screaming at me and threatening me with his various weapons. I thought it was just unbelievable. I loved it. So I encourage people to go see that. Ben or Benjamin, how about you? What have you been doing this last week? You're getting close to the festival, I know, for one thing.
Festivals. Near approaching. I tell you what I'm going to do this next week is get a hold of Bruce and talk about getting these Maori folks out to Folklife for the festival is what we're going to try and do. But no, we're you know, full steam ahead. We just got our final confirmations out last week. The weekend before that, I was up in Vancouver for the Canadian Folk Music Awards as a delegate, and you know, just meeting a bunch of different festival producers around Canada, which was really wonderful. Something that that my co-director and I have been talking about for a long time is like how do we create circuits and relationships with other festivals in meaningful ways where we can kind of share best practices and billings, and you know, Canada's got that all worked out. So I don't actually know what happened this last week. It's a blur. I can really just tell you the things that are going on in my head at any given moment. But the festival is coming up soon. We're really excited about it. It'll be, you know, last year when we had our we came back in person, it was going to be a test, right? It was right in the middle of, or I guess towards the end of COVID, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And so this year, I know, you know, the COVID mandate or the city mandate has been lifted, and I'm really looking forward to seeing people come out and feel a little bit more comfortable experiencing their own folk.
Yeah, for sure. It will be interesting, and I'm sure people will take you up on that too. The festival, I'll bet, will be in full bloom.
Yeah, I think so too.
Which will be great. You said that, you know, you can only basically say what's going on in your head at any one time. I can't even do that. I'm looking at my notes here as to what I did the last week, and I see a thing I wrote about getting a can of whole kernel corn from IGA to bring home for dinner tonight. that's not the list I was looking for. I had fun. I had my first Thursday morning scramble show on Thursday of all days, and we were celebrating the 90th birthday month of Willie Nelson. He will be 90 at the end of the month, and I, knowing Willie, he's probably celebrating all this month and all next month. So we played some of his more well-known and lesser-known tunes that people requested. That was fun. Tomorrow, speaking of the future, I'm going to VCA to listen to Bob Horsley and Bruce Mercer's Ride the Divide presentation they're making about their bicycle ride from Canada to Mexico. Looking forward to that. And a few other things, but we won't bore you with the rest of them. Let me talk about a couple more things before we get into our small talk discussion. Today, the 11th of April is the 104th day of the year. That's 94 days left before we reach the warm, sunny days of our Vashon Strawberry Festival that starts on July 14th. And only 45 days till the opening of the 52nd Folklife Festival at the Seattle Center. In 1968, on this day, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1968, prohibiting discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of housing. Lyndon Johnson did do a lot for civil rights, had some other issues with regards to a little war in Southeast Asia. In 1976, the Apple I was created. That was a while ago, 1976. And in 2011, Chicago Blues guitar player Lacey Gibson died, which I thought was kind of an interesting fact in light of our guest today, who is an accomplished blues guitar player, violin player, mandolin player, anything with strings on it. This is National Pet Day, International Luai Luai Day, National 8-Track Day, for those of you who remember 8-Tracks. And most importantly, International Be Kind to Lawyers Day. Or is that International Hug a Lawyer as he walks down the street day? One of those, I think, it's something like that.
Whatever prompted us to have a day like that, I wonder.
Well, it's international.
Yeah.
It's the old expression. Everybody hates lawyers except for their own lawyer. They typically like their own lawyer. Hopefully they like their own lawyer.
You can say that about legislators too, I think, in large
That's right.
large part.
Yep. Yeah. All right, let's get into our small talk segment. I've got Benjamin Hunter with me. But first, a little bit about Benjamin Hunter. Benjamin Hunter is an award-winning multi-instrumentalist, composer, community activist, social entrepreneur, and educator. His work explores the intersections of music and art, community, policy, and culture. In 2016, Benjamin's American Roots duo with Joe Siemens took first place in the International Blues Competition. Yeah. In 2018, he composed the music for the critically acclaimed production Black Boys, With his primary instrument, the violin, he is as comfortable playing classical as he is playing the blues and jazz. City Arts magazine wrote, quote, "The music he plays not only spans an array of genres, but a huge swath of history." Ben also, as I indicated, is very accomplished on not only violin, but guitar and mandolin. Benjamin is an incredible musicologist. He's an historian. He's a studier of music in general and an accomplished musician. Now, Benjamin is the artistic director of Northwest Folklife, and most of you know what Northwest Folklife is, but some of you may be a little confused. Northwest Folklife itself is an independent 501c3 arts organization that celebrates the multi-generational arts, cultures, and traditions of a global Pacific Northwest. Since 1972, Northwest Folklife has been deeply committed to celebrating the diversity of our Northwest communities and demystifying our differences together under one roof. All right, Mr. Hunter, tell us how you became the artistic director of Northwest Folklife and what do you do in that role?
How I became, well, I interviewed, and I got the job. But I think along with the music that I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 12 or 13 years, on tour, I also started a nonprofit back in 2011 called Community Arts Create. And, the goal of that organization, was kind of taking, my years of being a teacher for violin and realizing that, you know, there's a lot more value or there's a different value rather in creating a place for a less pedagogical, maybe didactic experience for music, and something that was a little bit more geared in sharing, in a shared experience, in a communal experience, where people could learn by just playing or listening or just being a part of a party. So I guess in 2011, I really became a professional party planner because that's ultimately what the job became, right? It was about experiencing art, whether it was visual art or culinary art or music or dance. You know, it was about bringing people together to share their own experiences of it, and I think ultimately that's what Folklife is, right? It's an opportunity for folks to recognize their own creative abilities and their own identity through culture, through something that is inherent within them, within everybody. I think it's an interesting idea to think about. We can get into this later, but our creative ecosystem and our creative economy, whereby we kind of subscribe artists in this kind of like entertainment, almost hobby kind of grouping, yet we refuse to recognize how vital they are to our economy, and that these are jobs, these are careers, these are things that people dedicate their lives to doing, whether it's music or wood carving or whatever. That craft is just as important as a lawyer or an educator or, you know, a doctor. And so I wanted to instill that in people's minds with Community Arts Create. And then over the years, I started the Hillman City Collaboratory, which kind of helped expand the arts into other levels of professions. And then I co-founded a space called the Black and Tan Hall, which was across the street, which is a performing arts space and restaurant. And so I think all of those things kind of culminated in effectively what we do at Folklife, right? Which is celebrating people. That's what folk is at the end of the day, is celebrating people.
That's a good segue. Because I think a lot of our listeners, and this has always been an issue, I remember when I was on the board, when you mention Folklife, they go, oh, the festival. And you go, oh, well, you know, there's a little bit more to Folklife than the festival. The festival obviously is the, you know, the centerpiece. It's you know, it's a huge part of the business plan in terms of finances, but and raising money. But what's the difference between Northwest Folklife and Folklife Festival?
Well, I like to talk about it in terms of like lowercase and capital F. There's Folklife, which is the institution and the organization, and I think to your point, right, a lot of people think of Folklife and they think of the festival. And while for, you know, I guess many years, really a couple decades, there have been programs that the organization has done outside of the festival, but it really hasn't been too prolific. And then there's Folklife with the lowercase F, which I like to think is every day. It's us right now sitting here and talking and like actually having a chat with people. It's a mother or a father or a grandmother or an auntie or uncle, like imparting a cookie recipe to their grandchild. It's playing music in the backyard. It's all the things that we do on a regular day to reaffirm our individual and our collective identities. And so Folklife is really trying to pivot whilst keeping the flagship festival alive. How do we celebrate the other 361 days of the year with Folklife, lowercase F, whether that's through programming and partnerships with other organizations, or just using our privilege of being a 52-year-old organization to raise awareness and about all the things that are going around in our city, in our region, in our county, in our state, that underscore Folklife with a lowercase F.
You know,
hashtag Folklife. Right.
You know, the residents of Vashon, which I understand you've been trying to become one for many years.
Yeah.
Keep trying.
I will.
I think subscribes thoroughly to that philosophy. They say that they're what? Half of us are musicians or artists or performers or craftsmen or whatever the case may be, and the other half are the people who listen and buy and, you know. We have our share of artists on this island. Truman, you got your hand up.
Yeah. I love the saying that I've heard multiple times about Vashon. Vashon has a population of about 11,000 people. And of those, 50,000 are musicians, and the rest are artists. So
That's right.
They kind of said it, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
That's good. Kevin.
So, Ben, listening to you talk about this vision of bringing people together and sharing this information, you know, thoughts to me come to mind for like the porch of the roastery, the Cafe Luna, right? It's got tables, chairs inside and outside, various gathering places. How from Folklife's perspective, this vision you painted, how do you create those connections in the areas that you work? And how does Folklife reach out to connect with people?
Well, it's not quick, you know. This is a long-term vision, right? And it really does require relationships and trust. You know, folk communities around the world, you know, don't just happen. They happen through building trust with folks. And I think you know, one, that's just the inevitability of it, but also that's how you ensure that it's going to be something substantial. And so, you know, yeah. any event or program or idea that, you know, that gets kind of like either developed in my brain or on the programming team's brain or within Folklife really does have to just immediately, you just have to at least add a year to that planning process, right? Because it might happen sooner than that, of course. And obviously we bring our relationships that we've had in the past into those conversations. But you know, it's really about making sure that we are truly and authentically working in collaboration and in partnership and towards collective achievement. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of ways that's antithetical, right, to the American dream, which is pick things up by your bootstraps, individual, like I can do this on my own. But the fact of it is that we don't do that. And I think part of the job is not just like leaning on those relationships and continuing to build and mature and marinate those relationships. Mm-hmm. But it's also about modeling what that looks like so that people I don't think, how do I say this? So that people remember. I think inherently, people know that that's how things have to be. And I think we forget about it because we're so caught up in the rat race. We're so caught up in all the things that we have to do to get through the day, right? You know, and I'm guilty of it myself. You know, I go home and I hang out with the family. I put the kid to bed and then I'm like, okay, man, I got to sit down at the computer, get some work done again. You know, like, you know, like instead of, you know, sit down with a nice glass of single malt and enjoy my evening, you know? And so I think that, you know, it's about accepting the fact that, you know, if you're going to do anything right and well, it's going to have to take time. It's like a gumbo. You know, it you can't make gumbo in an hour, and if you do, it's gonna taste horrible. So, or it's just not gonna be good. You know, it's not gonna be as good as it could be. And I think
we get that, yeah.
And I think if we all just kind of took that approach, you know, things would be a lot easier because we would understand that instant gratification isn't actually the satisfaction that we need. And I think the pandemic kind of proved that. Right, because we didn't have the opportunity to go out and culture those relationships and maintain those relationships. We were by ourselves and we were depressed. And the thing that kept us alive, right, was ironically, you know, playing music through the same devices that are also can alienate us. So it's a matter, I think, of recognizing and leaning into these new technologies also and seeing how can we use them to create relationships and culture relationships rather than like tear us apart from them.
Go ahead, Truman.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing. One thing that I saw very early on in the pandemic was the school program. There was one where it was an orchestra, I believe, of young kids, and they were all playing from home on their instrument, and some very bright person put this all together, and it was fabulous. I mean, it was such a wonderful combination of collaboration between all of these kids, and using, as you said, using the technology that's available to us today. But anyway, that totally blew me away.
Well, and it's something that Folklife is leaning on as well. You know, we for 2020 and 2021, we produced a virtual festival. And that festival was seen in over 900 cities and over 60 countries around the world. Which is amazing, but there's that kind of like outside the United States component or outside of Seattle component, but there are also, you know, many, many, many people that watched it from their homes a mile away from what would have been the festival. And so we're continuing that virtual component of the festival, not just because it connects, you know, immigrant families to their communities in other parts of the world, but it also, from an accessibility perspective, underscores that there are people that aren't able to leave their houses or leave their domiciles or wherever they're at due to, you know, myriad reasons. And here's an opportunity for us to use technology to connect with them and have, you know, have that meaningful kind of exchange of art and culture and reaffirming identity.
Let me focus in on that just a little bit. That discussion that you engaged in, pretty mind expanding, actually. Maybe a little more in the mundane is the fact that a lot of people have trouble defining what folk festival or folk music or what is, if to use the legal term, what's the jurisdiction of folk life? What types of things does it deal with?
I make so many people frustrated because they're like, who's your target audience? And I was like, everybody. Yeah. They're like, no, I need to know who your target audience is. And I'm like, no, it's everybody. I mean, to me, folk is anything that people do to be in community, you know. And so, you know, if we're talking about the development of house music in the 70s and 80s, amidst a time when queer BIPOC folks were being dismissed as they continue to be, house music was a way for them to gather and dance and exist and see each other. The same exists for you know, hip hop in Brooklyn and Long Island and Queens. The same exists for go-go music in DC. You know, some of these more contemporary styles of music are all elements of are all examples of folk music. You know, it's not just, you know, and I recognize who I'm on conversation with. You know, it's not just an elderly white guy with a beard and a banjo under a tree playing you know some sort of folk tune.
I resemble that.
but
dueling banjos.
Dueling banjos. Yeah. But the thing is that it is that. That is it. That's a truth. But it's also other things. And so, you know, if we continue to go down the road where, and this is a recording industry situation. I mean, when the recording industry was built in the early part of the 20th century, there was race records and hillbilly records, right? Because the recording industry, as young and naive and racist as it was like, black people want to listen to music that we know black people make, which is blues and gospel, and white people want to listen to music that we think we know white people listen to, which is fiddle tunes and like sacred church hymns, right? Ignoring the fact that all that music was being played by all the people, right? There was a huge community between Irish folks and Africans before slavery was codified, in this country, where everybody was indentured servants, right? And at the lowest caste of the people were Irish and Africans, and they built those are the building blocks of what we consider bluegrass and old time and those Appalachian traditions, and so. If we remove all the genres and we just think about what is the music or the dance or the craft or the activity or the whatever that people are doing together, that's folk. And that's everything. So really, there is just one genre, which is folk, which is the argument I'm trying to make.
Bruce, did you have your hand up there, or were you just waving at me?
I'm just waving. Oh.
waving in agreement.
Hey.
But Benjamin's right. I mean, even what we call classical music really started out, you know, basically from Gregorian chants and, you know, developed. And I mean, it everything is folk music. And I think that's a great way to look at it. You know, it's not – that sense we tend to divide things into these genres and categories just because our minds can't accept the fact that it's all connected. It's all one thing.
Get somebody like Elvis Presley who came in and just blew it all away, you know. He combined it all. He just said, hey.
That's a whole other discussion, isn't it?
Yeah, no, but I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah,
that's,
no.
That's right. Yeah.
So you're telling me, Benjamin, that at Folk Life, if you go to Folk Life for the 4 days of Folk Life at the Seattle Center, you're going to hear more than bluegrass it's going to be more than just music too. It's going to be other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be way more than just bluegrass. It's going to be, Carnatic music from India. It's going to be, Korean music. It's going to be folklorico. It's going to be bluegrass. It's going to be blues. It's going to be, there's these two guys that put together this video called Space Cadets, which is using pop music and visuals to bring young kids into what music is and what it takes to make music and write music and explore music. So it's all those things. But also we have a thing called and Kevin, this might interest you, it's called Kuleana Corridor. Kuleana is a Hawaiian term that effectively means responsibility, accountability. And this is this year's cultural focus is called Lagom, L-A-G-O-M, and that's a Scandinavian term that effectively means balance, not too much, not too little, just right. And so it's our approach to kind of taking control of our responsibility to our environment, to climate change. Like how can we produce a festival And impart values to people that come to this festival that recognize that, you know, we have to make changes and we have to think about what our accountability is to our earth, considering that folk music is defined by the environments that we're in. You know, like if we think about, I always use this example. This was given to me by a friend of mine, Justin Robinson, who's out in North Carolina. But if we look at the instruments that are coming out of Nigeria or the Congo, where there is a lot more trees and rainforest, then quite naturally a lot of the music is going to be more drums. And if we go to the semi-arid regions of Africa, where there's a lot less trees and a lot more goats and gourds, then the music is going to be, you know, ngonis and akontins and koras and instruments that are string-based, because that's the materials that we have around us. So if we think about that, and if we think about our relationship to the earth, you know, the music and the art and the craft that we make is a direct relationship to the environment that we steward and that we culture. And so the Kuleana Corridor is going to be an emphasis on, you know, communities that are championing food sovereignty, food justice, food access, food security. We have a maker space, which is a hands-on opportunity for folks to learn craft by, like, actually hands-on, you know, working with crafters that are building stuff. We had last year we had a person with a lathe come in and make wands and teaching kids about woodworking. And then we're also doing a fashion show this year called Threads of the People, which is less a fashion show that you would think of, like, from a Zoolander perspective or like some, you know, Italian Milan kind of thing. But recognizing that, like, all these outfits, these incredible costumes and beautiful fabrics come out of all these different cultures from around the world, and how are those, again, to my other point about reflection of our environment, how are those costumes like a reflection of the environment that these folks and these cultures are coming out of? So just, like, you know, thinking about that, you know, like we live in a city, so we live in a rainy city, and you know, apparently when I moved here, that meant that everybody had to wear stuff from REI and Patagonia. So I guess that's our fashion.
Exactly. Hey, you know, I wanted to mention, I'm glad you were talking about some of the African music. I just recently had the opportunity to hear Sona Jabarte, who plays the kora. She's one of the only professional women kora players in the world.
Yeah, Jazz Alley.
Exactly. And she was amazing. I mean, and that music was so thrilling to this Northwest audience. I mean, it was really amazing. And she has a Vashon connection.
Oh, does she?
One of the people that brought her here was a gentleman who, Jacob Bain, who is a musician here on the island, but he's also a filmmaker. And they met on the beach in Africa. I don't even know, Mozambique or wherever. And he shot the video for her latest video production. And so he convinced her to come to Seattle and perform at Jazz Alley, and actually brought her out to the island for a short tour.
Well, if you're listening, would you say Jason, Justin?
Jacob Bain.
Bain, if you're listening, we need to talk. The core is my favorite instrument by far. I think it's just magnificent.
Amazing.
You know, that brings up another issue with regards to folk life, the festival. The festival rarely has any headliners. Mm-hmm. It's, like you say, it's the culture, traditions, music, et cetera, the people. And you don't necessarily have to be a headliner in order to do that. And I was just looking, I think that Bumbershoot, and I don't mean to demean Bumbershoot, it's a whole different kind of gathering. Their tickets are, I think they reduced them to something like $200. And how much does it cost to get into Folklife Festival?
Well, I'm going to answer this the easy way, and I'm going to answer this a little bit more deeply.
Nuanced,
a little bit more deeply. We consider Folklife a ticketless festival. You know, we stress the importance of accessibility, that folk music is for the people, and so we're a ticketless festival. Although we do, you know, ask that people make a daily donation of $20 if they can. But if they can't, of course, it's still open and available for them to enjoy. But I should mention that Bumper Shoot and Folk Life started the same year. They're both the same age. And while Bumper Shoot is celebrating their 50th anniversary because they took the 2-year hiatus over the pandemic, they started at the same time. And Folk Life was a folk based festival in these kind of like arcane definitions that we're talking about. Although I will just say as a quick anecdote that Vivian and Phil Williams, who founded the festival, I think very much believed in the methodology and approach that we're taking with folk music now. And that's a whole other conversation, but they believed that folk was a global thing. And not just reserved to fiddles and banjos. But Bumper Shoot was also free when it started, and it was the pop equivalent of Folk Life, and it was free, and it was for local musicians and entertainers and performers. And of course that changed over the years to where they kind of developed into being a headliner festival. Folk Life is not a headliner festival, although we do have a lot of professional musicians that perform at the festival, paired with a lot of folks that are exquisite musicians or performers or dancers, but have other jobs. And so, you know, do this in community for the joy and pleasure of doing it, not just for the career component as well. But I will say that this year is the first year that Folk Life will be paying performers to play at the festival. It's not a lot. It's not a lot of money, but it is in understanding that this creative ecosystem that we have here, and by that I mean that, like, just to give you some stats, in 2019 the Creative Economy Report for Seattle illustrated that about 18-19% of the GDP of Seattle, I guess not GDP, gross GRP, whatever that is, was 18% for creative economy. That meant that 18% of the money that was coming into the city was due to creative enterprise, right? Yet, you know, our artists and our musicians and our people that are engaging in this kind of profession of art can't afford to live in this city. They can't afford to shop in the city. They can't afford to do anything in the city because rent is high, houses are high, everything is high. And so what does that say about our city if so much of our economy is dependent on creative resources, that we aren't providing a livable space for those creators? And so, you know, Folk Life is taking the position to serve as to use our position to advocate for a stronger, you know, more equitable creative economy. And that means, you know, doing what we can, even if it's little at this early stage, to pay artists that want to be paid.
You know, that brings up another issue with regards to just how to support Folk Life. Obviously, by making those contributions as you walk in or out of the festival grounds is a major way of doing it. I was there when we first instituted that over the objections of a lot of people. But just asking for charitable donations. Are there other ways that people can support Folk Life?
Well, we always are looking for volunteers. You know, there's a lot of jobs that we can do, greeting and emceeing and stuff like that, go a long way in helping support the festival. Certainly, your donation is invited, whether it's the $20 a day or if it's something more substantial as a larger gift. But you know, I would also just say in advocacy for this economy, this ecosystem that I'm talking about, is like, go to a show. Pay the money to go to a show. Buy a CD, buy a record, buy a t-shirt. You know, go out into the world and celebrate art with the people that are making this art. Because, you know, Bob Dylan always said that, you know, folk will never die. And I do believe that folk music won't ever die, but it can disappear and go into hiding, and be less available. And so, you know, support Folklife is a regional festival. Go places. Go to Seattle. Go to Tacoma. Go to Olympia, Bellingham, Yakima, Spokane, Oregon, Portland. Go to these places and support artists, because their work is meaningful. And I think all of you guys out there in the world listening to this recognize that. So if it costs $5 or $10 or $20 to go see a show, just don't buy your Starbucks coffee that day. Or whatever. No shame against Starbucks, but just don't do it. Just make your own coffee at home and then go out and see a show later that night.
You know, Kevin, did you have your hand up there?
Well, I do want to just say I really appreciate, Ben, the opportunity for us and our listeners to be immersed in your vision of Folklife, how it applies, how it really moves us in if we allow it to, you know, every day. Your vision of kind of growing and expanding our collective resilience and sustainability through the things that could be shared through Folklife is very inspiring. So I just really wanted to make sure to have the opportunity to thank you for bringing that view to us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that it makes me appreciate Vashon a little more and thinking of it in those terms, for what we do here. I think we have a very unique community in that we do get out and we do appreciate our performers and all the local folks. So, but anyway, thank you for bringing that out. That's excellent.
No, I agree. I think Vashon is really wonderful in that sense. The Strawberry Festival, my son loves the Strawberry Festival. And we try and come out here as often as we can, because I love that people sell eggs on the side of the road. I love that, you know, and it's communal. There's nobody there to like make that exchange. You just kind of put some money into the bucket and grab an egg or 12 and go.
I know. Have you been to the Coop? Okay, we need to get you out to the Coop someday.
Oh, that
sounds like my kind of place.
It is exactly your kind of place. Yeah. I'll tell you. Those are people getting together and making great music and having a wonderful time. Hey, for those of you who are really interested in finding out more, volunteering, becoming a friend of Folklife, learning more about the festival, the website's very simple. It's NW, as in Northwest, nwfolklife.org. Or if you want to learn a little bit more about Benjamin Hunter and listen to some of his music, go to benjaminhuntermusic.com. That's a wonderful website as well. I think Folklife is very, very lucky to have you, Ben. And I appreciate you sharing your experiences with you today. I wish we could spend a lot more time with you, and hopefully we will in the future.
Thank you.
I hope you have luck finding a place out here on Vashon. No mean trick.
I do. Yes, listen up, Windermere and John L. Scott. Listen up. You need to find an opportunity.
All right. I'll tell you what.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. We're going to move on to a little discussion in the last 10 minutes here or so. And, of course, Ben, you are very welcome to join in on some of these subject matters.
Happily.
There are certain words you're not permitted to use on the radio.
I read that.
They're right there.
I read that a couple times, yeah.
I'm glad you didn't read it out loud. with that, let's move into a couple of things. The one that comes up, that's a few of them that are timely. One is the Texas federal judge ban on the sale of mifepristone, the abortion pill. And the other are the Tennessee Three, the three Tennessee representatives that were excluded, run out of the legislature, and then slowly it seems two of them were, and
two
one of them,
yeah.
One of them has just been brought back yesterday. Let's start with the Texas. That particular case, one federal judge out of Amarillo has banned the sale of the so-called abortion pill, which is used for other things besides abortion, by the way. And a Washington court did basically the opposite. A Washington federal judge said that the FDA must continue to keep mifepristone on the market. As a matter of fact, Governor Inslee, when he heard about this about a month ago, ordered a 3-year stockpile of the drug. And the University of Washington independently stockpiled another year of this particular drug, because we have in Washington attempted to protect the right to abortion through our laws. Any thoughts generally on this Texas judge's activities, Truman?
Well, being a former Texan, I'm really appalled at this action. And forget about what the drug's used for. That to me is the least important part of it. That what's important is that one individual judge can throw out the incredible research and documentation that our FDA has gone through to approve a treatment. And this one guy, all on his own, throws out 20 years of work. That just, to me, strikes of anarchy. I mean, I just cannot get past that portion of it.
Kevin?
Yeah, I'd say just say goodbye to your aspirin now. You know, it's exactly. Who knows what the future is. But the other thought was, I was listening to the back and forth debate about what this judge did and the strength of the case and all of that stuff. I also thought of the Florida judge who basically gave the former president kind of a pass on the Mar-a-Lago classified documents situation, where basically put up all kinds of roadblocks to the Department of Justice, you know, pursuing evidence in that case. And what came to mind for me is, how long will it take for us to hopefully wash these federal judges with this display of uncertain I'm not even sure what term to use, right? How long will it take now for some of these justices to be sidelined? And Craig, of course, you have experience, of course, in this world. I don't know what happens to these judges. Do they just keep on going until they retire and bringing their stupendous views to us? Or is there some other method by which we might get to a more equitable solution a little quicker?
Quickly, I don't know. The federal judges have tenure, lifetime tenure. And the only way to for them to leave office is becoming sick, dying, or being impeached. That's sort of where it lies.
Or a congressional change, right?
Not the existing federal judges. The appointed federal judges are there for the duration. The question is, you want to make sure that the individuals who are appointing new judges are appointing good judicial minds and are not politically motivated. Bruce, did you have your hand up?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's what we've heard from some of our more conservative colleagues over the last 40 or 50 years about activist judges and legislating from the bench. And you go back to Brown versus the Board of Education, and the reaction to that was much in the same of what we're seeing today from the left in the reaction to this federal court judge. And my sense is one of the failures of the Constitution was to set up a judiciary system with no boundaries. You know, Congress has boundaries, the president has boundaries, the executive, the legislative all have boundaries. They're called elections. The judiciary does not. And that's one of the failures of the Constitution. And it's sort of, do we need to address that? I mean, is there a way to build in accountability into the judicial system without having it be, you know, at the whim of particular political winds, if you will? And that's really a larger constitutional question. And Craig, that falls into your bailiwick. But
yeah.
It seems to me that that's an issue that we will have to deal with in the next 20, 30 years here in the United States.
Right. We do have obviously some checks and balances, not many. But, you know, as we find out lately, the United States Supreme Court has not imposed certain requirements upon themselves like virtually every other group of judges in the United States have. that put boundaries on their ethical behavior. Just from a legal standpoint, I might just mention the problem with that Texas case, and I think the reason why it might get overturned is not because it's one judge making a decision for the entire United States and all, and that he's a anti-abortionist before he came on the court and all those horrible things. But there's a doctrine known as judicial deference to administrative agencies. The expertise lies typically with the agency, and to a certain degree with their interpretation of law, to a much greater degree when it comes to their interpretation of their own regulations, and to a tremendous degree when it comes to the actions that they do in furtherance of their calling. And that's what this is. This is the expertise of the doctors and the scientists whose decisions seem to have been disregarded in this opinion. And I predict that the opinion will be overturned eventually. Bruce, did you have your hand up?
No, I'm scratching my head.
Oh, okay. Fine. Go ahead. Continue.
You know, I did have a comment, though, and on what Bruce was saying. He was saying about being no oversight of the judiciary. And, you know, if you look at the stuff that Jim Jordan is doing, so that's kind of past, you know, on the other side of that. So there's got to be some happy medium in there where you know, you're not giving too much power to any of the one of the three branches.
There's always that issue of the pendulum swinging in reaction to bad situations and going too far and having those unintended consequences. That doesn't mean we shouldn't take a look at trying to address that. Kevin.
Yeah, I'll just say briefly, of course, what we have now is an administration who's going to be putting judges on the bench that are probably definitely more in line with our values and hopefully bringing more integrity in terms of the rulings and so some of those provisions that you mentioned. I understand that the, you know, kind of the latest request is to contact senators and let them know to get rid of the blue slip, which apparently is a process which is slower and requires more engagement of the Senate in order to put judges on the bench. And it's my impression it's more of a courtesy, not a requirement. So if we want to improve the Biden administration's ability to put judges on the bench, then ask your senators to remove this blue slip provision, which they're currently operating under.
Mm-hmm. 2 minutes left. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, Bent had a comment.
Just to offer a bit of optimism. because I get frustrated too, and you know it's hard to read the news and not want to bang your head against the wall for all the things that, I mean, we haven't even gotten to the other issues that you wanted to talk about, because right, because it's easy to fall into this hole that is kind of despairing. I heard Reverend Barber speak a number of years ago. He was the leader of Moral Mondays down in North Carolina. And he was asked, you know, things are just getting more egregious. Things are getting, you know, on the conservative side or on the other side, like things are just getting worse and worse and worse. And he made this comment that was like, that was basically, you know, when put into a corner, you know, anybody's going to do whatever they can to get out of that corner. Right, and they're gonna go the lengths that they need to fight their way out of that. And what that says, what he was alluding to, right, is like, you know, the arc to justice, as MLK said, is bending, right, and we are going in that direction, and the reactions on the opposite side are just gasping for air right now. And so I think it's imperative to remember that, like, we just need to keep going. And keep being, you know, dogged in our fight towards justice, because these institutional oppressions are crumbling bit by bit, and these are just last ditch efforts to save a patriarchy that has controlled the narrative for so long.
Ben, you get the last word, as they say. Bruce, tell us about next week's Small Talk guests, Tyra Taylor and Shelley Means. What are they going to be talking about?
Actually, we're going to have the CEO, executive director of the Seattle Indian Health Board, and their communications director. So Esther Lucerno, who's Dine, and Tierra Taylor, who is Sunaimok, will both be here with us, talking about the Seattle Indian Health Board purchase of the BCC facility. So it should be a fascinating discussion.
It should be. Okay, for Ben, Truman, Kevin, Bruce, I am Craig Bellis. Hope you will all join us next Tuesday for the next edition of the Brown Briefly. Bye now.
Have a great week.
Cheers, y'all. Nice talking to you.